Chapter 29. Adolf Eichmann and Me. I spent 2 days in that queer basement, as a meditative invalid. My clothes had been ruined in the beating I'd taken, so from the resources of Jones's household, I was given other clothes. I was given a pair of shiny black trousers by Father Keeley, a silver-colored shirt by Dr. Jones, a shirt that had once been part of the uniform of a defunct American fascist movement called, straightforwardly enough, the Silver Shirts. And the Black Führer gave me a tiny orange sports coat that made me look like an organ grinder's monkey. And Raisi Nolte and George Kraft kept me company tenderly. Not only nursed me, but did my dreaming and planning for me as well. The big dream was to get out of America as soon as possible. Conversations, in which I took very little part, were a sort of roulette, played with the names of warm places purported to be Edens. Acapulco, Minorca, Rhodes, even the Vale of Kashmir, Zanzibar, and the Andaman Islands. The news from the outside world was not such as to make my remaining in America attractive, or even conceivable. Father Keeley went out and bought newspapers several times a day, and for supplementary enlightenment, we had the blatting of the radio. The Republic of Israel stepped up its demands for me, encouraged by rumors that I wasn't an American citizen, that I was, in fact, a citizen of nowhere. And the Republic's demands were framed so as to be educational, too, teaching that a propagandist of my sort was as much a murderer as Heydrich, Eichmann, Himmler, or any of the gruesome rest. That may be so. I had hoped, as a broadcaster, to be merely ludicrous. But this is a hard world to be ludicrous in, with so many human beings so reluctant to laugh, so incapable of thought, so eager to believe and snarl and hate. So many people wanted to believe me. Say what you will about the sweet miracle of unquestioning faith, I consider a capacity for it terrifying and absolutely vile. West Germany asked the government of the United States politely if I might be a citizen of theirs. They had no proof one way or another, since all records pertaining to me had burned during the war. If I was a citizen of theirs, they said, they would be as pleased as Israel to have me for trial. If I was a German, they said in effect, they were certainly ashamed of a German like me. Soviet Russia, in short words that sounded like ball bearings being dropped into wet gravel, said that no trial was necessary. A fascist like me, they said, should be squashed underfoot like a cockroach. But it was the anger of my neighbors that really stank of sudden death. The more barbaric newspapers printed without comment letters from people who wanted me displayed from coast to coast in an iron cage. From heroes who volunteered to serve in a firing squad for me, as though the use of small arms were a skill known to few. From people who planned to do nothing themselves, but were confident enough in American civilization to know that there were other, stronger, younger people who would know what to do. And these last-named patriots were right in having confidence. I doubt if there has ever been a society that has been without strong and young people eager to experiment with homicide, provided no very awful penalties are attached to it. According to the newspapers and radio, justifiably angry people had already done what they could about me, breaking into my ratty attic, smashing my windows, tearing up or carting off my worldly goods. The hated attic was now under police guard around the clock. The New York Post pointed out editorially that the police could scarcely give me the protection I needed, since my enemies were so numerous and so understandably murderous. What was called for, said the Post helplessly, was a battalion of Marines to surround me for the rest of my days. The New York Daily News suggested that my biggest war crime was not killing myself like a gentleman. Presumably, Hitler was a gentleman. The News, incidentally, also printed a letter from Bernard B. O'Hare, the man who had captured me in Germany, the man who had recently written me a letter with copious carbons.
"I want this guy all for myself," O'Hare wrote of me. "I deserve this guy all for myself. I was the guy who caught him in Germany. If I'd known then he was going to get away, I would have blown his head off right then and there. If anybody sees Campbell before I do, tell him Bernie O'Hare is on his way from Boston by nonstop plane."
The New York Times said that tolerating and even protecting vermin like me was one of the maddening necessities in the life of a truly free society. The United States government, as Raisi had told me, was not going to turn me over to the Republic of Israel. There was no legal machinery for that. The United States government did promise, however, to make a full and open review of my puzzling case, to find out exactly what my citizenship status was, to find out why I had never even been brought to trial. The government expressed queasy surprise that I was even within its borders. The New York Times published a portrait of me as a much younger man, my official portrait as a Nazi and idol of the international airwaves. I can only guess at the year in which the picture was taken, 1941, I think. Arndt Klopfer, the photographer who took the picture of me, did his best to make me look like a Maxfield Parish Jesus covered with cold cream. He even gave me a halo, a judiciously placed spot of nebulous light in the background. The halo was no special effect for me alone. Everybody who went to Klopfer got a halo, including Adolf Eichmann. I can say that for certain about Eichmann, without asking for confirmation from the Haifa Institute, because Eichmann had his picture taken just ahead of me at Klopfer's studio. It was the only time I ever met Eichmann, the only time in Germany. I met him again here in Israel only 2 weeks ago, when I was incarcerated briefly in Tel Aviv. About that reunion, I was locked up in Tel Aviv for 24 hours. On my way to my cell there, the guards stopped me outside Eichmann's cell to hear what we had to say to each other, if anything. We didn't recognize each other, and the guards had to introduce us. Eichmann was writing the story of his life, just as I am now writing the story of my life. That chinless old plucked buzzard, with 6 million murders to explain away, gave me a saintly smile. He was sweetly interested in his work, in me, in the guards in the prison, in everybody. He beamed at me and he said, "I'm not mad at anybody." "That's certainly the way to be," I said. "I've got some advice for you," he said. "I'd be glad to have it," I said. "Relax," he said, beaming, beaming, beaming. "Just relax." "That's how I got here," I said. "Life is divided up into phases," he said. "Each one is very different from the others, and you have to be able to recognize what is expected of you in each phase. That's the secret of successful living." "It's good of you to share the secret with me," I said. "I'm a writer now," he said. "I never thought I'd be a writer." "May I ask you a personal question?" I said.
"Certainly," he said benignly. "That's the phase I'm in now. This is the time for thinking and answering. Ask whatever you like."
"Do you feel that you're guilty of murdering 6 million Jews?" I said.
"Absolutely not," said the architect of Auschwitz, the introducer of conveyor belts into crematoria, the greatest customer in the world for the gas called Cyclone B. Not knowing the man for sure, I tried some intramural satire on him, what seemed to me to be intramural satire. "You were simply a soldier, were you?" I said, "taking orders from higher-ups, like soldiers around the world?" Eichmann turned to a guard and talked to him in rapid-fire Yiddish, indignant Yiddish. If he'd spoken it slowly, I would have understood it, but he spoke too fast. "What did he say?" I asked the guard.
"He wondered if we'd showed you his statement," said the guard. He made us promise not to show it to anybody until it was done.
I haven't seen it, I said to Eichmann. Then how do you know what my defense is going to be? He said. This man actually believed that he had invented his own trite defense. Though a whole nation of 90-some-odd million had made the same defense before him. Such was his paltry understanding of the godlike human act of invention. The more I think about Eichmann and me, the more I think that he should be sent to the hospital, and that I am the sort of person for whom punishments by fair, just men were devised. As a friend of the court that will try Eichmann, I offer my opinion that Eichmann cannot distinguish between right and wrong, that not only right and wrong, but truth and falsehood, hope and despair, beauty and ugliness, kindness and cruelty, comedy and tragedy are all processed by Eichmann's mind indiscriminately, like birdshot through a bugle. My case is different. I always know when I tell a lie, am capable of imagining the cruel consequences of anybody's believing my lies. No cruelty is wrong. I could no more lie without noticing it than I could unknowingly pass a kidney stone. If there is another life after this one, I would like very much in the next one to be the sort of person of whom it could truly be said, "Forgive him, he knows not what he does." This cannot be said of me now. The only advantage to me of knowing the difference between right and wrong, as nearly as I can tell, is that I can sometimes laugh when the Eichmanns can see nothing funny. You still write? Eichmann asked me, there in Tel Aviv. One last project, I said, a command performance for the archives. You are a professional writer? He said. Some say so, I said. Tell me, he said, do you set a certain time of day aside for writing, whether you feel like it or not, or do you wait for inspiration to strike night or day? A schedule, I said, remembering back so many years. I got some of his respect back. Yes, yes, he said, nodding, a schedule. That's what I found, too. Sometimes I simply stare at a blank sheet of paper, but I still sit here and stare at it for the whole period I've set aside for work. Does alcohol help? I think it only seems to. And only seems to for about half an hour, I said. This, too, was an opinion from my youth. Eichmann made a joke. Listen, he said. About those 6 million? Yes, I said. I could spare you a few for your book, he said. I don't think I really need them all. I offer this joke to history, on the assumption that no tape recorder was around. This was one of the memorable quips of the bureaucratic Genghis Khan. It's possible that Eichmann wanted me to recognize that I had killed a lot of people, too, by the exercise of my fat mouth. But I doubt that he was that subtle a man of as many parts as he was. I think, if we ever got right down to it, that out of the 6 million murders generally regarded as his, he wouldn't lend me so much as one. If he were to start farming out all those murders, after all, Eichmann, as Eichmann's idea of Eichmann, would disappear. The guards took me away, and the only other encounter I had with the man of the century was in the form of a note, smuggled mysteriously from his prison in Tel Aviv to mine in Jerusalem. The note was dropped at my feet by a person unknown in the exercise yard here. I picked it up, read it, and this is what it said. Do you think a literary agent is absolutely necessary? The note was signed by Eichmann. My reply was this. For book club and movie sales in the United States of America, absolutely. Chapter 30.
Don Quixote.
We would fly to Mexico City, Kraft, Raisi, and I. That became the plan.
Dr. Jones would not only provide us with transportation, he would provide us with a reception committee in Mexico City as well. From Mexico City, we would go exploring by automobile, would seek some secret village in which to spend the rest of our days. The plan was surely as charming a daydream as I had had in many a day, and it seemed not only possible but certain that I would write again. Shyly, I told Raisi so. She wept for joy. For real joy? Who knows? I can only guarantee that the tears were wet and salty.
"Did I have anything to do with this lovely, this heavenly miracle?" she said.
"Everything," I said, holding her close.
"No, no. Very little," she said. "But some, thank God. Some. The big miracle is the talent you were born with."
"The big miracle," I said, "is your power to raise the dead."
"Love does that," she said, "and it raised me too. How alive do you think I was, before?"
"Shall I write about it?" I said. "In our village there in Mexico, on the rim of the Pacific, is that what I should write first?"
"Yes, yes, oh yes, darling, darling," she said. "I'll take such good care of you while you do it. Will you have any time for me?"
"The afternoons and the evenings and the nights," I said. "That's all the time I'll be able to give you."
"Have you decided on a name yet?" she said.
"Name?"
I said. "Your new name. The name is a new writer whose beautiful works come mysteriously out of Mexico," she said. "I will be Mrs.
Senora," I said.
"Senora who?" she said. "Senor e Senora who?"
"Christen us," I said. "It's too important for me to decide right away," she said. Kraft came in at this point. Raisi asked him to suggest a pseudonym for me.
"What about Don Quixote?" he said. "That," he said to Raisi, "would make you Dulcinea del Toboso. And I would sign my paintings Sancho Panza."
Dr. Jones now came in with Father Keeley.
"The plane will be ready tomorrow morning," he said. "You sure you'll be well enough to travel?"
"I'm well enough right now," I said.
"The man who'll meet you in Mexico City is Arndt Klopfer," said Jones. "Can you remember that?"
"The photographer," I said.
"You know him?" said Jones.
"He took my official photograph in Berlin," I said.
"He's the biggest brewer in Mexico now," said Jones.
"For God's sake," I said. "The last I heard, his studio got hit with a 500-pound bomb."
"You can't keep a good man down," said Jones. "Now then, Father Keeley and I have a special request to make of you."
"Oh," I said.
"Tonight is the weekly meeting of the Iron Guard of the White Sons of the Constitution," said Jones. "Father Keeley and I want to stage some sort of memorial service for August Kraptauer."
"I see," I said.
"Father Keeley and I don't think we could deliver the eulogy without breaking down," said Jones. "It would be a terrible emotional ordeal for either one of us. We wonder if you, a very famous speaker, a man with a golden tongue, if I may say so, we were wondering if you would accept the honor of saying a few words."
I could hardly refuse.
"Thank you, gentlemen," I said.
"A eulogy?"
"Father Keeley thought up a general theme, if that would help," said Jones.
"It would help a lot, a general theme would," I said. "I could certainly use one."
Father Keeley cleared his throat.
"I think the theme should be," that addled old cleric said, "His truth goes marching on."
Chapter 31. His Truth Goes Marching On.
the Iron Guard of the White Sons of the American Constitution, assembled on ranks of folding chairs in the furnace room of Dr. Jones's basement. The guardsmen were 20 in number, ranging in age from 16 to 20. They were all blonde. They were all over 6 feet tall. They were neatly dressed, wore suits and white shirts and neckties. All that identified them as guardsmen was a little piece of gold ribbon run through the buttonhole of the right lapel of each. I would not have noticed this odd detail of buttonholes on the right lapels, lapels that conventionally have no buttonholes, if Dr. Jones hadn't pointed it out to me.
"It's a way they have of identifying each other, even though the ribbon isn't worn," he said. "They can see their ranks growing," he said, "without anybody else noticing it."
"They all have to take their coats to tailors and insist on buttonholes in the right lapel," I said.
"The mothers do it," said Father Keeley.
Keeley, Jones, Rezzy, and I were sitting on a raised platform facing the guardsmen, our backs to the furnace. Rezzy was on the platform because she had agreed to say a few words to the boys about her first-hand experiences with communism behind the Iron Curtain.
"Most tailors are Jews," said Dr. Jones. "We don't want to tip our hand."
"Besides," said Father Keeley, "it's good for the mothers to participate."
Jones's chauffeur, the Black Führer of Harlem, was now on the platform with us, hanging a big canvas sign behind us, tying its grommeted ends to steam pipes. This is what it said: "Get plenty of education, lead your class in all things, keep your body clean and strong, keep your opinions to yourself."
"These are neighborhood kids?" I asked Jones. "Oh, no," said Jones. "Only 8 of them are even from New York City. 9 are from New Jersey, 2 are from Peekskill, the twins, and 1 comes all the way from Philadelphia."
"Every week he comes from Philadelphia," I said.
"Where else can he get what August Kraptower was offering here?" said Jones.
"How were they recruited?" I said.
"Through my paper," said Jones. "But they really recruited themselves. Worried, conscientious parents were writing to the White Christian Minuteman all the time, asking me if there wasn't some youth movement that wanted to keep the American bloodstream pure. One of the most heartbreaking letters I ever saw was from a woman in Bernardsville, New Jersey. She'd let her boy go into the Boy Scouts of America, not knowing that the true name of the BSA ought to be the Boogies and Semites of America. And the boy got to be an Eagle Scout, and then he went into the army, went over to Japan, and came home with a Japanese wife."
"When August Kraptower read that letter, he cried," said Father Keeley. "That's when he knew, tired as he was, he had to get back to working with youth again."
Father Keeley called the meeting to order, had us all pray. His prayer was a conventional one, asking for courage in the face of hostile hosts. There was one unconventional touch, however, a touch I had never heard of before, even in Germany. The Black Führer stood over a kettle drum in the back of the room. The drum was muffled. Muffled, as it happened, by the simulated leopard skin I had worn earlier for a bathrobe. At the end of each sentence in the prayer, the Black Führer gave the muffled drum a thump. Rezzy's talk on the horrors of life behind the Iron Curtain was brief and dull, and so unsatisfactory from an educational standpoint that Jones had to prompt her.
"Most devoted communists are of Jewish or Oriental blood, aren't they?" he asked her.
"What?" she said.
"Of course they are," said Jones. "It goes without saying," he said. And he dismissed her rather curtly.
Where was George Kraft? He was sitting in the audience, in the very last row, next to the muffled kettle drum. Jones introduced me next. Introduced me as a man who needed no introduction. He said I wasn't to start talking yet because he had a surprise for me. He certainly did. The Black Führer left his drum, went to a rheostat by the light switch,
and dimmed the lights gradually as Jones talked. Jones told, in the gathering darkness, of the intellectual and moral climate in America during the Second World War. He told of how patriotic, thoughtful white men were persecuted for their ideals, how, finally, almost all the American patriots were rotting in federal dungeons.
"Nowhere could an American find the truth," he said. The room was pitch dark now. "Almost nowhere," said Jones in the dark. "If a man was fortunate enough to have a shortwave radio," he said, "there was still one fountainhead of truth, just one."
And then, in the darkness, there was the crackle and susurrus of shortwave static. A fragment of French, a fragment of German, a fragment of Brahms' First Symphony, as though played on kazoos. And then, loud and clear, "This is Howard W. Campbell, Jr., one of the few remaining free Americans, speaking to you from Free Berlin. I wish to welcome my countrymen, which is to say the native white Gentiles of the 106th Division taking up positions before St. Vith tonight. To the parents of the boys in this Green Division, may I say that the area is presently a quiet one. The 442nd and 444th Regiments are one line, the 423rd in reserve. There is a fine article in the current Reader's Digest with the title, 'There Are No Atheists in Foxholes.' I should like to expand this theme a little and tell you that, even though this is a war inspired by the Jews, a war that only the Jews can win, there are no Jews in foxholes either. The riflemen in the 106th can tell you that. The Jews are all too busy counting merchandise in the quartermaster corps, or money in the finance corps, or selling black market cigarettes and nylons in Paris to ever come closer to the front than 100 miles. You folks at home, you parents and relatives of boys at the front, I want you to think of all the Jews you know. I want you to think hard about them. Now then, let me ask you, is the war making them richer or poorer? Do they eat better or worse than you do? Do they seem to have more or less gasoline than you do? I already know what the answers to all those questions are. And so will you, if you'll open your eyes and think hard for a minute. Now let me ask you this. Do you know of a single Jewish family that has received a telegram from Washington, once the capital of a free people? Do you know of a single Jewish family that has received a telegram from Washington that begins, 'The Secretary of War desires me to express his deep regret that your son,' and so on?" There were 15 minutes of Howard W. Campbell, Jr., the free American, there in the basement darkness. I do not mean to suppress my infamy with a casual "and so on." The Haifa Institute for the Documentation of War Criminals has recordings of every broadcast Howard W. Campbell, Jr. ever made. If someone wants to go over those broadcasts, wants to cull from them the very worst things I said, I have no objection to those culls being attached to this account as an appendix. I can hardly deny that I said them. All I can say is that I didn't believe them, that I knew full well what ignorant, destructive, obscenely jocular things I was saying. The experience of sitting there in the dark, hearing the things I'd said, didn't shock me. It might be helpful in my defense to say that I broke into a cold sweat, or some such nonsense. But I've always known what I did. I've always been able to live with what I did. How? Through that simple and widespread boon to modern mankind, schizophrenia. There was one adventure in the dark worth reporting, though. Somebody put a note in my pocket, did it with intentional clumsiness so that I would know the note was there. When the light came on again, I could not guess who had given me the note.
I delivered my eulogy of August Kaptauer, saying, incidentally, what I pretty much believe, that Kaptauer's sort of truth would probably be with mankind forever, as long as there were men and women around who listened to their hearts instead of their minds. I got a nice round of applause from the audience, and a drum roll from the Black Führer. I went into the lavatory to read the note. The note was printed on lined paper torn from a small spiral notebook. This is what it said. Kolbin door unlocked. Leave at once. I am waiting for you in vacant store directly across street. Urgent. Your life is in danger. Eat this. It was signed by my blue fairy godmother. By Colonel Frank Wirtanen.
Chapter 32. Rosenfeld. My lawyer here in Jerusalem, Mr. Alvin Dobrowitz, has told me that I would surely win my case if I could produce one witness who had seen me in the company of the man known to me as Colonel Frank Wirtanen. I met Wirtanen three times, before the war, immediately after the war, and finally, in the back of a vacant store across the street from the residence of the Reverend Dr. Lionel J.D. Jones, DDS, DD. Only at the first meeting, the meeting on the park bench, did anyone see us together. And those who saw us were no more likely to fix us in their memories than were the squirrels and birds. The second time I met him was in Wiesbaden, Germany, in the dining hall of what had once been an officer's candidate school of the Engineer Corps of the Wehrmacht. There was a great mural on the wall of that dining hall, a tank coming down a lovely, winding country lane. The sun was shining in the mural. The sky was clear. This bucolic scene was about to be shattered. In a thicket, in the foreground of the mural, was a merry little band of steel-helmeted Robin Hoods, engineers, whose latest prank was to mine the lane and to implement the impending merriment with an anti-tank gun and a light machine gun. They were so happy. How did I get to Wiesbaden? I was taken from a Third Army prisoner of war pen near Ohrdruf on April 15th, 3 days after my capture by Lieutenant Bernard B. O'Hare. I was driven to Wiesbaden in a jeep, was guarded by a first lieutenant whose name is unknown to me. We didn't talk much. I did not interest him. He spent the entire trip in a slow, smoldering rage about something that had nothing to do with me. Had he been slighted, insulted, cheated, maligned, grievously misunderstood? I don't know. At any rate, I don't think he would be much help as a witness. He was carrying out orders that bored him. He asked his way to the camp, and then to the dining hall. He left me at the door of the dining hall, told me to go inside and wait, and then he drove off, leaving me unguarded. I went inside, though I might easily have wandered into the countryside again. Inside that melancholy barn, all alone, seated on a table under the mural, was my blue fairy godmother. Wirtanen was wearing the uniform of an American soldier. Zippered jacket, olive drab trousers and shirt, the shirt open at the neck, combat boots. He had no weapon. Neither did he wear any symbol of rank or unit. He was a short-legged man. When I saw him sitting there on the table, he was swinging his feet, and his feet were far off the floor. He must have been at least 55 then, 7 years older than when last I'd seen him. He was bald, had put on weight. Colonel Frank Wirtanen had the impudent, pink baby look that victory and an American combat uniform seemed to produce in so many older men. He beamed at me, and he shook my hand warmly, and he said, "Well, what did you think of that war, Campbell?" "I would just as soon have stayed out of it," I said. "Congratulations," he said. "You lived through it anyway. A lot of people didn't, you know." "I know," I said. "My wife, for instance." "Sorry about that," he said.
I found out she was missing the same day you did, he said.
How? I said.
From you, he said. That was one of the pieces of information you broadcast that night.
This news, that I had broadcast the coded announcement of my Helga's disappearance, broadcast it without even knowing what I was doing, somehow upset me more than anything in the whole adventure. It upsets me even now. Why? I don't know. It represented, I suppose, a wider separation of my several selves than even I can bear to think about. At that climactic moment in my life, when I had to suppose that my Helga was dead, I would have liked to mourn as an agonized soul, indivisible. But no. One part of me told the world of the tragedy in code. The rest of me did not even know that the announcement was being made. That was vital military information that had to be got out of Germany at the risk of my neck, I said to Wirtanen.
Certainly, he said. The instant we got it, we began to act.
To act, I said, mystified. To act how?
To find a replacement for you, said Wirtanen. We thought you'd kill yourself before the sun came up again.
I should have, I said.
I'm damn glad you didn't, he said.
I'm damn sorry I didn't, I said. You would think that a man who spent as much time in the theater as I have would know when the proper time came for the hero to die, if he was to be a hero. I snapped my fingers softly. There goes the whole play about Helga and me. Nation of two, I said. Because I missed my cue for the great suicide scene.
I don't admire suicide, said Wirtanen.
I admire form, I said. I admire things with a beginning, a middle, an end, and whenever possible, a moral, too.
There's a chance she's still alive, I guess, said Wirtanen.
A loose end, I said. An irrelevancy. The play is over.
You said something about a moral, he said.
If I'd killed myself, when you expected me to kill myself, I said, maybe a moral would have occurred to you.
I'll have to think, he said.
Take your time, I said.
I'm not used to things having form, or morals either, he said. If you died, I probably would have said something like, God damn, now what'll we do? A moral? It's a big enough job just burying the dead, without trying to draw a moral from each death, he said. Half the dead don't even have names. I might have said you were a good soldier.
Was I? I said.
Of all the agents who were my dream children, so to speak, you were the only one who got clear through the war both reliable and alive, he said. I did a little morbid arithmetic last night, Campbell. Calculated that you, by being neither incompetent nor dead, were 1 in 42.
What about the people who fed me information? I said.
Dead. All dead, he said. Every one of them a woman, by the way. 7 of them in all. Each one of them, before she was caught, living only to transmit information to you. Think of it, Campbell. 7 women you satisfied again and again and again. And they finally died for the satisfaction that was yours to give them. And not one of them betrayed you either, when she was caught. Think of that, too.
I can't say you've relieved any shortage of things to think about, I said to Wirtanen. I don't mean to diminish your stature as a teacher and philosopher, but I had things to think about even before this happy reunion. So what happens to me next?
You've already disappeared again, he said. Third Army's been relieved of you. And there'll be no records here to show that you ever arrived. He spread his hands. Where would you like to go from here? And who would you like to be?
I don't suppose there's a hero's welcome awaiting me anywhere, I said.
Hardly, he said.
Any news of my parents, I said?
I'm sorry to tell you, he said. They died 4 months ago.
Both, I said?
Your father first. Your mother, 24 hours later. Heart both times, he said.
I cried a little about that,
shook my head. Nobody told them what I was really doing, I said.
Our radio station in the heart of Berlin was worth more than the peace of mind of two old people, he said.
I wonder, I said.
You're entitled to wonder, he said. I'm not.
How many people knew what I was doing, I said.
The good things or the bad things, he said.
The good, I said.
Three of us, he said.
That's all, I said.
That's a lot, he said. Too many, really. There was me. There was General Donovan. And one other.
Three people in all the world knew me for what I was, I said. And all the rest. I shrugged.
They knew you for what you were, too, he said abruptly.
That wasn't me, I said, startled by his sharpness.
Whoever it was, said Wirtanen. He was one of the most vicious sons of bitches who ever lived.
I was amazed. Wirtanen was sincerely bitter.
You give me hell for that? Knowing what you do? I said. How else could I have survived? That was your problem, he said. Very few men could have solved it as thoroughly as you did.
You think I was a Nazi? I said.
Certainly you were, he said. How else could a responsible historian classify you? Let me ask you a question.
Ask away, I said.
If Germany had won, had conquered the world.
He stopped, cocked his head.
You must be way ahead of me. You must know what the question is.
How would I have lived, I said? What would I have felt? What would I have done?
Exactly, he said. You must have thought about it with an imagination like yours.
My imagination isn't what it used to be, I said. One of the first things I discovered when I became an agent was that I couldn't afford an imagination anymore.
No answer to my question, he said.
Now is as good a time as any to see if I've got any imagination left, I said. Give me a minute or two.
Take all the time you want, he said.
So I projected myself into the situation he described, and what was left of my imagination gave me a corrosively cynical answer. There is every chance, I said, that I would have become a sort of Nazi Edgar Guest, writing a daily column of optimistic doggerel for daily papers around the world. And, as senility set in, the sunset of life, as they say, I might even come to believe what my couplet said, that everything was probably all for the best. I shrugged. Would I have shot anybody? I doubted. Would I have organized a bomb plot? That's more of a possibility. But I've heard a lot of bombs go off in my time, and they never impressed me much as a way to get things done. Only one thing can I guarantee you. I would never have written a play again. That skill, such as it was, is lost. The only chance of my doing something really violent in favor of truth or justice or what have you, I said to my blue fairy godmother, would lie in my going homicidally insane. That could happen. In the situation you suggest, I might suddenly run amok with a deadly weapon down a peaceful street on an ordinary day. But whether the killing I did would improve the world much would be a matter of dumb luck, pure and simple. Have I answered your question honestly enough for you? I asked him.
Yes, thank you, he said.
Classify me as a Nazi, I said tiredly. Classify away. Hang me, if you think it would tend to raise the general level of morality. This life is no great treasure. I have no post-war plans.
I only want you to understand how little we can do for you, he said. I see you do understand.
How little, I said?
A false identity? A few red herrings? Transportation to wherever you might conceivably start a new life, he said. Some cash. Not much, but some.
Cash, I said? How was the cash value of my services arrived at?
A matter of custom, he said. A custom going back to at least the Civil War.
Oh, I said.
Privates pay, he said. On my say-so, you're entitled to it for the period from when we met in the Tiergarten to the present.
That's very generous, I said.
Generosity doesn't amount to much in this business, he said. The really good agents aren't interested in money at all. Would it make any difference to you if we gave you the back pay of a brigadier general?
No, I said.
Or if we paid you nothing at all?
No difference, I said.
It's almost never money, he said. Or patriotism either.
What is it then? I said.
Each person has to answer that question for himself, said Wirtanen. Generally speaking, espionage offers each spy an opportunity to go crazy in a way he finds irresistible.
Interesting, I said emptily. He clapped his hands to break the mood.
Now then, he said, about transportation, where to?
Tahiti, I said.
If you say so, he said. I suggest New York. You can lose yourself there without any trouble, and there's plenty of work if you want it.
All right. New York, I said.
Let's get your passport picture taken. You'll be on a plane out of here inside of 3 hours, he said.
We crossed the deserted parade ground together, dust devils spinning here and there. It was my fancy to think of the dust devils as the spooks of former cadets at the school, killed in war, returning now to whirl and dance on the parade ground alone. To dance in as unmilitary a fashion as they damn well pleased.
When I told you there were only 3 people who knew about your coded broadcasts, said Wirtanen.
What about it, I said.
You didn't ask who the 3rd one was, he said.
Would it be anybody I'd ever heard of, I said.
Yes, he said. He's dead now, I'm sorry to say. You used to attack him regularly in your broadcasts.
Oh, I said.
The man you called Franklin Delano Rosenfeld, said Wirtanen. He used to listen to you gleefully every night.
Chapter 33. Communism Rears Its Head. The 3rd time I met my blue fairy godmother, and the last time, from all indications, was, as I have said, in a vacant shop across the street from the house of Jones. Across the street from where Raisi, George Kraft, and I were hiding. I took my time about going into that dark place, expecting, with reason, to find anything from an American Legion color guard to a platoon of Israeli paratroopers waiting to capture me inside. I had a pistol with me, one of the Iron Guard's Lugers, chambered for .22s. I had it not in my pocket, but in the open, loaded and cocked, ready to go. I scouted the front of the shop without showing myself. The front was dark, and then I approached the back in short rushes from cluster to cluster of garbage cans. Anybody trying to jump me, to jump Howard W. Campbell, Jr., would have been filled with little holes, as though by a sewing machine. And I must say that I came to love the infantry, anybody's infantry, in that series of rushes and taking cover. Man, I think, is an infantry animal. There was a light in the back of the shop. I looked through a window and saw a scene of great serenity. Colonel Frank Wirtanen, my blue fairy godmother, was sitting on a table again, waiting for me again. He was an old, old man now, as sleek and hairless as Buddha. I went in. I thought surely you would have retired by now, I said.
I did, he said. 8 years ago. Built a house on a lake in Maine, with an axe and an adze and my own 2 hands. I was called out of retirement as a specialist.
In what, I said.
In you, he said.
Why the sudden interest in me, I said.
That's what I'm supposed to find out, he said.
No mystery why the Israelis would want me, I said.
I agree, he said. But there's a lot of mystery about why the Russians should think you were such a fat prize.
Russians, I said. What Russians?
The girl, Raisi Noth. And the old man. The painter. The one called George Kraft, said Wirtanen. They're both communist agents. We've been watching the one who calls himself Kraft now since 1941. We made it easy for the girl to get into the country, just to find out what she hoped to do.
Chapter 34. Alles kaputt. I sat wretchedly on a packing case. With a few well-chosen words, I said, "You've wiped me out. How much poorer I am in this minute than I was in the minute before." "Friend, dream, and mistress," I said, "alles kaputt."
"You've still got a friend," said Wirtanen.
"What do you mean by that?" I said.
"He's like you," said Wirtanen. "He can be many things at once, all sincerely."
He smiled.
"It's a gift."
"What was he planning for me?" I said.
"He wanted to uproot you from this country, get you to another one where you could be kidnapped with fewer international complications. He tipped off Jones as to where and who you were. Got O'Hare and other patriots all stirred up about you again. All as part of a scheme to pull up your roots."
"Mexico. That was the dream he gave me," I said.
"I know," said Wirtanen. "There's a plane waiting for you in Mexico City right now. If you were to fly down there, you wouldn't spend more than 2 minutes on the ground. Off you'd go again, bound for Moscow in the latest jet, all expenses paid."
"Dr. Jones is in on this too," I said.
"No," said Wirtanen. "He's got your best interests at heart. He's one of the few men you can trust."
"Why should they want me in Moscow?" I said. "What do the Russians want with me, with such a moldy old piece of surplus from World War II?
"They want to exhibit you to the world, as a prime example of the sort of fascist war criminal this country shelters," said Wirtanen. "They also hope that you will confess to all sorts of collusion between Americans and Nazis at the start of the Nazi regime."
"Why would I confess such a thing?" I said. "What do they plan to threaten me with?"
"That's simple," said Wirtanen. "That's obvious."
"Torture," I said.
"Probably not," said Wirtanen. "Just death."
"I don't fear it," I said.
"Oh, it wouldn't be for you," said Wirtanen.
"For whom, then?" I said.
"For the girl you love. For the girl who loves you," said Wirtanen. "The death, in case you are uncooperative, would be for little Raisi Noth."
Chapter 35. 40 rubles extra. "Her mission was to make me love her," I said.
"Yes," said Wirtanen.
"She did it very well," I said sadly. "Not that it was hard to do."
"Sorry to have such news for you," said Wirtanen.
"It clears up some mysteries." "Not that I wanted them cleared up," I said. "Do you know what she had in her suitcase?"
"Your collected works,"
he said. "You knew about that, too? To think they would go to such pains to give her props like those. How did they know where to look for those manuscripts?"
"They weren't in Berlin. They were neatly stored in Moscow," said Wirtanen.
"How did they get there?" I said.
"They were the main evidence in the trial of Stepan Botaskov," he said.
"Who?" I said.
"Stepan Botaskov was a corporal, an interpreter with the first Russian troops to enter Berlin," said Wirtanen. "He found the trunk containing your writings in a theater loft. He took the trunk for booty."
"Some booty," I said.
"It turned out to be remarkably fine booty," said Wirtanen. "Botaskov was fluent in German. He went through the contents of the trunk, and he decided that he had a trunk full of instant career. He started modestly, translating a few of your poems into Russian and sending them off to a literary magazine. They were published and praised." "Botaskov next tried a play," said Wirtanen. Which one? I said.
The goblet, said Wirtanen. Bodiskov translated that into Russian, and he had himself a villa on the Black Sea, practically before they'd taken the sandbags down from the windows of the Kremlin.
It was produced, I said?
Not only was it produced, said Wirtanen, it continues to be produced all over Russia by both amateurs and professionals. The goblet is the Charlie's Aunt of contemporary Russian theater. You're more alive than you thought, Campbell.
My truth goes marching on, I murmured.
What? Said Wirtanen.
I can't even tell you what the plot of the goblet is, I said. So Wirtanen told it to me.
A blindingly pure young maiden, he said, guards the Holy Grail. She will surrender it only to a knight who is as pure as herself. Such a knight comes along and is pure enough to win the Grail. By winning it, he causes the girl to fall in love with him, and he falls in love with her, said Wirtanen. Do I really have to tell you, the author, the rest?
It's as though Bodiskov really did write it, I said. As though I'm hearing it for the first time.
The knight and the girl, said Wirtanen, continuing the tale, they begin to have impure thoughts about each other, tending involuntarily to disqualify themselves from any association with the Grail. The heroine urges the hero to flee with the Grail before he becomes unworthy of it. The hero vows to flee without the Grail, leaving the heroine worthy of continuing to guard it. The hero makes their decision for them, said Wirtanen, since they have both become impure in thought. The Holy Grail disappears. And stunned by this unanswerable proof of their depravity, the two lovers confirm what they firmly believe to be their damnation with a tender night of love. The next morning, confident of hellfire, they promise to give each other so much joy in life that hellfire will be a very cheap price to pay. The Holy Grail thereupon appears to them, signifying that heaven does not despise love like theirs. And then the Grail goes away again, forever, leaving the hero and the heroine to live happily ever after.
My God. I did write that, didn't I? I said.
Stalin was crazy about it, said Wirtanen.
And the other plays, I said?
All produced, all well received, said Wirtanen.
But the goblet was Bodiskov's big hit, I said.
The book was the biggest hit of all, said Wirtanen.
Bodiskov wrote a book, I said.
You wrote a book, said Wirtanen.
I never did, I said.
Memoirs of a Monogamous Casanova?
Said Wirtanen. It was unprintable, I said.
A publishing house in Budapest will be amazed to hear that, said Wirtanen. I'd guess they've printed something like 500,000 copies.
The communists let a book like that be published openly, I said.
Memoirs of a Monogamous Casanova is a curious little chapter in Russian history, said Wirtanen. It could hardly be published with official approval in Russia. And yet, it was such an attractive, strangely moral piece of pornography. So ideal for a nation suffering from shortages of everything but men and women. That presses in Budapest were somehow encouraged to start printing it. And those presses have, somehow, never been ordered to stop.
Wirtanen winked at me.
One of a few sly, playful, harmless crimes a Russian can commit at no risk to himself is smuggling home a copy of Memoirs of a Monogamous Casanova. And for whom does he smuggle it? To whom is he going to show this hot stuff? To that salty old crony, his wife. For years, said Wirtanen, there was only a Russian edition. But now it is available in Hungarian, Romanian, Latvian, Estonian, and most marvelous of all, German again.
Bodiskov gets credit as the author, I said.
It's common knowledge that Bodiskov wrote it, though the book carries no credits, publisher, author, and illustrator supposedly unknown. Illustrator, I said?
Harrowed by the idea of pictures of Helga and me cavorting in the nude.
14 plates in lifelike color, said Wirtanen. 40 rubles extra.
Chapter 36. Everything but the squeals. If only it weren't illustrated, I said to Wirtanen angrily.
That makes a difference, he said.
It's a mutilation, I said. The pictures are bound to mutilate the words. Those words weren't meant to have pictures with them. With pictures, they aren't the same words. He shrugged.
It's pretty much out of your control, I'm afraid, he said. Unless you want to declare war on Russia.
I closed my eyes wincingly. What is it they say in the Chicago stockyards about what they do to a pig?
I don't know, said Wirtanen.
They boast that they find a use for everything about a pig, but his squeal, I said.
So?
Said Wirtanen. That's how I feel right now, I said. Like a pig that's been taken apart, who's had experts find a use for every part. By God, I think they even found a use for my squeal. The part of me that wanted to tell the truth got turned into an expert liar. The lover in me got turned into a pornographer. The artist in me got turned into ugliness such as the world has rarely seen before. Even my most cherished memories have now been converted into cat food, glue, and liverwurst, I said.
Which memories are those?
Said Wirtanen. Of Helga. My Helga, I said. And I wept. Raisi killed those. In the interests of the Soviet Union. She made me faithless to those memories. And they can never be the same again. I opened my eyes. F all, I said quietly. I suppose the pigs and I should feel honored by those who proved our usefulness. I'm glad about one thing.
Oh?
Said Wirtanen. I'm glad about Boduskov, I said. I'm glad somebody got to live like an artist with what I once had. You said he was arrested and tried?
And shot, said Wirtanen.
For plagiarism, I said.
For originality, said Wirtanen. Plagiarism is the silliest of misdemeanors. What harm is there in writing what's already been written? Real originality is a capital crime, often calling for cruel and unusual punishment in advance of the coup de grace.
I don't understand, I said.
Your friend, Kraft Potapov, realized that you were the author of a lot of things Boduskov claimed to have written, said Wirtanen. He reported the facts to Moscow. Boduskov's villa was raided. The magic trunk containing your writings was discovered under straw in the loft in his stable.
So, I said.
Every word by you in that trunk had been published, said Wirtanen.
And, I said.
Boduskov had begun to replenish the trunk with magic of his own, said Wirtanen. The police found a 2,000-page satire on the Red Army, written in a style distinctly un-Boduskovian. For that un-Boduskovian behavior, Boduskov was shot. But enough of the past, said Wirtanen. Listen to what I've got to tell you about the future. In about half an hour, he said, looking at his watch, Jones's house is going to be raided. The place is surrounded now. I wanted you out of there, since it's going to be a complicated enough mess as it is.
Where do you suggest I go? I said.
Don't go back to your flat, he said. Patriots have taken the place apart. They'd probably take you apart, too, if they caught you there.
What's going to happen to Raisi? I said.
Deportation is all, said Wirtanen. She hasn't committed any crimes.
And Kraft, I said.
A good long stretch in prison, he said. That's no shame. I think he'd rather go to prison than home anyway. The Reverend Lyle J.D. Jones, DDS, DD, said Wirtanen, will go back to prison for illegal possession of firearms, and whatever else of a straightforward criminal nature we can pin on him. Nothing is planned for Father Keeley, so I imagine he'll drift back to Skid Row again. The Black Führer will be set adrift again, too.
And the Iron Guardsman, I said?
The Iron Guardsmen of the White Sons of the American Constitution, said Wirtanen, are going to get an impressive lecture on the illegality in this country of private armies, murder, mayhem, riots, treason, and violent overthrow of the government. They'll be sent home to educate their parents, if such a thing is possible.
He looked at his watch again.
You'd better go now. Get clear out of the neighborhood.
Can I ask you who your agent in Jones's house is? I said. Who was it that slipped the note into my pocket, telling me to come here?
You can ask, said Wirtanen. But you must surely know I won't tell you.
You don't trust me to that extent, I said.
How could I ever trust a man who's been as good a spy as you have? Said Wirtanen.
Chapter 37. That Old Golden Rule. I left Wirtanen, but I hadn't taken many steps before I understood that the only place I wanted to be was back in Jones's cellar, with my mistress and my best friend. I knew them for what they were, but the fact remained that they were all I had. I returned by the same route over which I had fled, went in through Jones's coal bin door. Raisy, Father Keeley, and the Black Führer were playing cards when I got back. Nobody had missed me. The Iron Guard of the White Sons of the American Constitution was having a class in flag courtesy in the furnace room, a class conducted by one of its own members. Jones had gone upstairs to write, to create. Kraft, the Russian master spy, was reading a copy of Life that had a portrait of Werner von Braun on the cover. Kraft had the magazine open to the center spread, a panorama of a swamp in the age of reptiles. A small radio was playing. It announced a song. The title of the song fixed itself in my mind. This is no miracle of total recall, my remembering the title. The title was apt for the moment. For almost any moment, actually. The title was That Old Golden Rule. At my request, the Haifa Institute for the Documentation of War Criminals has run down the lyric of that song for me. The lyric is as follows. Oh, baby, 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 why do you break my heart this way? You say you want to go steady, but then all you do is stray. I'm so confused, I'm not amused. You make me feel like such a fool. You smile and lie. You make me cry. Why don't you learn that old golden rule? What's the game? I said to the card players.
Old maid, said Father Keeley.
He was taking the game seriously. He wanted to win. And I saw that he had the queen of spades, the old maid, in his hand. It might make me seem more human at this point. Which is to say more sympathetic. If I were to declare that I itched and blinked and nearly swooned with a feeling of unreality. Sorry. Not so. I confess to a ghastly lack in myself. Anything I see or hear or feel or taste or smell is real to me. I am so much a credulous plaything of my senses that nothing is unreal to me. This armor-plated credulity has been continent even in times when I was struck on the head, or drunk, or, in one freakish adventure that need not concern this accounting, even under the influence of cocaine. There in Jones's basement, Kraft showed me the picture of von Braun on the cover of Life, asked me if I knew him. Von Braun, I said? The Thomas Jefferson of the space age? Sure. The Baron danced with my wife once at a birthday party in Hamburg, for General Walter Dornberger.
Good dancer? Said Kraft.
Sort of Mickey Mouse dancing, I said. The way all the big Nazis danced. If they had to dance.
You think he'd recognize you now?
Said Kraft.
I know he would, I said. I ran into him on 52nd Street about a month ago, and he called me by name. He was very shocked to see me in such reduced circumstances. He said he knew a lot of people in the public relations business, and he offered to talk to them about giving me a job.
You'd be good at public relations, said Kraft.
I certainly don't have any powerful convictions to get in the way of a client's message, I said. The game of old maid broke up, with Father Keeley the loser, with that pathetic old virgin still stuck with the Queen of Spades.
Well,
said Keeley, as though he'd won much in the past, as though a rich future were still his.
You can't win them all.
He and the Black Fuhrer went upstairs, pausing each few steps to count to 20. And then Raisi, Kraft Potapov, and I were alone. Raisi came over to me, put her arm around my waist, laid her cheek against my chest.
Just sink, darling, she said.
Hmm?
I said. Tomorrow, we'll be in Mexico, she said.
Hmm,
I said. You seem worried, she said.
Me worry, I said.
Preoccupied, she said.
Do I look preoccupied to you? I said to Kraft. He was studying the picture of the swamp again.
No,
he said. My good old normal self, I said.
Kraft pointed to a pterodactyl that was winging over the swamp.
Who would think a thing like that could fly?
He said.
Who would ever think that a ramshackle old fart like me would win the heart of such a beautiful girl and have such a talented, loyal friend besides, I said.
I find it very easy to love you, said Raisi. I always have.
I was just thinking, I said.
Tell me your thoughts, said Raisi.
Maybe Mexico isn't exactly what we want, I said.
We can always move on, said Kraft.
Maybe. There, at the Mexico City airport, I said. Maybe we could just get right on a jet.
Kraft put his magazine down.
And go where? He said.
I don't know, I said. Just go somewhere very fast. I suppose it's the idea of movement that excites me. I've been sitting still so long.
Hmm, said Kraft.
Moscow, maybe, I said.
What?
Said Kraft incredulously. Moscow, I said. I'd like very much to see Moscow.
That's a novel idea, said Kraft.
You don't like it, I said.
I'll have to think about it, he said.
Raisi started to move away from me, but I held her tight. You think about it too, I said to her.
If you want me to, she said faintly.
Heaven, I said. And I jiggled her to make her bubble. The more I think about it, the more attractive it becomes, I said. If we only stayed in Mexico City for 2 minutes between planes, that would be long enough for me. Kraft stood up, exercising his fingers elaborately.
This is a joke,
he said.
Is it, I said. An old friend like you should be able to tell if I'm joking or not. You must be joking, he said. What is there in Moscow that could interest you?
I try to locate an old friend of mine, I said.
I didn't know you had a friend in Moscow, he said.
I don't know that he's in Moscow. Just somewhere in Russia, I said. I'd have to make inquiries.
What's his name? Said Kraft.
Stepan Bodiskov, I said. The writer.
Oh,
said Kraft. He sat down again. Picked up the magazine again. You've heard of him, I said?
No,
he said. What about Colonel Iona Potapov, I said. Raisi twisted away from me, stood with her back to the farthest wall. You know Potapov? I asked her.
No, she said.
You?
I asked Kraft.
No, he said. Why don't you tell me about him?
He's a communist agent, I said. He's trying to get me to Mexico City, so I can be kidnapped and flown to Moscow for trial.
No, said Razi. Shut up, Kraft said to her.
He stood, threw the magazine aside. He went for a small pistol he had in his pocket, but I got the drop on him with a Luger. I made him throw the pistol on the floor.
Look at us, he said wonderingly,
as though he were an innocent bystander.
Cowboys and Indians.
Harvard, said Razi.
Don't say a word, Kraft warned her.
Darling, said Razi tearfully, the dream about Mexico. I thought it was really coming true. We were all going to escape. She opened her arms. Tomorrow, she said weakly. Tomorrow, she whispered again. And then she went to Kraft, as though she wanted to claw him. But there was no strength in her hands. The hold they took on Kraft was feeble.
We were all going to be born anew, she said to him brokenly. You, too, you, too. Didn't you want that for yourself? How could you speak so warmly about the new lives we would have and still not want them?
Kraft did not reply. Razi turned to me.
I am a communist agent, yes, and so is he. He is Colonel Iona Potapov, and our mission was to get you to Moscow. But I wasn't going to go through with it, because I love you. Because the love you gave me was the only love I've ever had, the only love I ever will have. I told you I wasn't going through with it, didn't I? She said to Kraft.
She told me, said Kraft.
And he agreed with me, said Razi. And he came up with this dream of Mexico, where we would all get out of the trap, live happily ever after.
How did you find out?
Kraft asked me. American agents followed the scheme all the way, I said. This place is surrounded now. You're cooked,